Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. So in this episode, I'm talking to Nicholas Hengen Fox about reading as collective action, which is his new book. He currently teaches literature writing and social justice at Portland Community College over in Oregon. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave. I'm so excited to be here. I've listened for a long time.
Oh, thank you. That's good to hear. This couldn't be more immediately relevant, I think, given the current political context. And it's quite strange that, given how long it takes for an academic book to appear, that reading as collective action would be, you know, kind of so of the moment and so now. One of the things that is clear from the project that underpins it is that it's been a long-running set of research interests. I guess one way to introduce the book and to talk about its immediate relevance is to put it in the context of that kind of longer-term bit of work that's led to it. So maybe you could kind of introduce the ideas and that kind of long gestation that the book has had for the listeners.
I'll try not to give you the really long, boring story, but the short version is that when I was starting graduate school, I got interested in this idea, and I was sort of inspired by one of the folks I was working with at UVA, Jerry McGann, that like you could understand texts kind of as something more than text, which, you know, was probably not a radical idea when I encountered it, but it was really transformative to me. And so I started to be interested in how texts lived in the world. So I wrote about poems on the subway and things like that. When I continued on later on, sort of studying, you know, going deeper into sort of Marxist theory and critical theory, I maintained that interest in sort of the material experience of texts in the world. And I think I was always looking for ways to kind of find texts outside of just what I might do with them or how I might interpret them. So this project is in a way kind of me searching, you know, for different ways to encounter people reading books and reading them in ways that kind of like a professional culture worker like me would not read them.
I guess this is summed up really neatly in this subtitle of the book, Texts as Tactics. And I guess that is the kind of almost the motif of moving us away from, not, you know, it's important obviously to think about how texts say things, but, you know, to move us more to where and to whom is kind of using texts.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that idea, and I will admit that I did not imagine having to say texts as tactics over and over again when I wrote that. It's quite a tongue twister. I wanted it to be the title, and the press was like, "No, it cannot be the title." And I was like, "Now I see why." Yeah, absolutely. And I think it took me a long time to sort of move away from looking for what I, as a kind of a teacher and a critic, am trained to see as good readings, you know, like high quality interpretive readings, and understand that there's like truly a lot of different ways that people engage with and interact with texts, and that there's a lot of value in those. So whether that's the sort of thoughtful interpretation, like of somebody in a sermon, which we can talk about later, or whether it's a person who read the first 10 pages and was like, I get this, but it's not my thing. I'm going to talk about it with some other folks and just use it as a way to sort of channel my experience. I think that kind of tactical approach to reading is interesting and really merits more attention from academics than it's received. Yeah.
I mean, the other thing is the kind of politics of the idea of thinking about tactics, because I suppose kind of situating reading and texts in a social set of practices is one element of what the book is doing. But the other is this idea about the text as being capable of changing the world. So it'd be interesting to know the aim of introducing this more social vision of the text.
Well, there's a lot of really great writing that was coming out while I was working on it about kind of like the affective dimension, right? Like we're I think it's not surprising to hear people say, oh, this book made me feel this way. Or, you know, like Timothy Aubrey wrote a great book called Reading is Therapy, about sort of how middle-class readers affectively engage with texts. But I was interested in sort of that more political turn. So looking for ways maybe that books engage in, and throughout the book, I use Nancy Fraser's ideas as one of the kind of guides of sort of recognition, representation, and redistribution. So how books can play a role in sort of fighting for justice. So, and I think that's really like kind of to your question, like that's the idea of politics that the book tries to pursue, is looking for these like concrete ways that we can say, not just, you know, this poem has a radical formal innovation, therefore it is political, but rather to say like, well, this poem showed up in this place and was seen by this many people who normally don't read poetry. And in that context, it would appear to be engaging in an act of, you know, recognition, or this poem allowed this group to get a grant, which allowed them to do this, which is an act of redistribution. So when we look at some of the case studies, I can be more specific, but that idea of really grounding politics, not just in, you know, kind of grand claims that because text, you know, does something or says something, it is sort of a priori political, and rather to say like, I saw something happen due to the way this person was using the text. That's sort of where I'm trying to ground the political intervention.
Yeah, and that element of kind of Nancy Fraser's work runs throughout the three case studies. And it's interesting, I mean, I say case studies, but, you know, the book is structured around these three types of use of text. And then there's a really interesting, more theoretical, I guess, kind of concluding moment in the text, which I found a really useful way of structuring the book, because as you just gestured towards, you know, it's much easier to kind of see these ideas play out in practice and then reflect on them theoretically. And I guess the really obvious place where that comes from and the response to September 11th, which is the first chapter of the book. And I guess the big question is kind of like, how and why was poetry important after September 11th, before we even begin to think about the kind of tactical reading that gives recognition and representation?
So I was actually, weirdly for the first time ever, I just sort of taught a version of this chapter with a class that I'm teaching about the literature of social protest. So it brought to mind that I probably, when we talk about September 11th, need to say like, kind of hit the historical reminder button a little bit. You know, it was a long time ago now. It's sort of historical. So after September 11th, as you know, and I'm sure many people here will listening would remember, like, which my students did not remember.
That makes it seem like a lot longer ago than it feels, in because it's, you know, obviously part of kind of living cultural memory for a certain generation, but I guess for younger people it isn't. So
I mean, some of my a few folks in the class actually had not been born, which was made me feel old, among other things. But so after September 11th, there was this, you know, really in the U.S., this really sort of vitriolic kind of Islamophobic thread that sort of lit up immediately in the cultural fabric. And there were, you know, I write about in the book, there were, you know, immediately journalists were being attacked for criticizing the president. Journalists were fired. College professors were disciplined for giving public speeches about motivations for terrorism, trying to sort of explain some of the whys. TV programs were canceled due to lost advertising. I mean, this was like a really hard time to sort of say things that I think now it's more common to hear people say, like, well, September 11th was, you know, tragically a result of some geopolitical behaviors of the United States. You know, it didn't just come out of nowhere. But at that moment, it was really, really hard to find kind of resistance, especially. And so I got interested, you know, in that context, I got interested in like, well, was there any way that literature was resistant? And I initially discovered people talking a lot about the Auden poem, September 1st, 1939, which is this, you know, beautiful and terrible poem by Auden about the Nazi invasion of Poland. But it is really redolent with September 11th. It evokes, a number of really specific sense kind of analogies, the smell of death and towers and a lot of other stuff. And so I was like, I wonder if there are other poems out there. And so using my kind of, academic training, I started digging through databases and sort of perusing, where else were poems showing up. What I found was like there was a lot of poems sort of circulating in strange ways after September 11th. In the journalistic accounts of it, people keep saying there are poems everywhere. And I mean, I think that's hyperbole, obviously, but there were certainly a lot of poems being published in a lot of places that they wouldn't normally be published, including Auden's poem. But as I discovered, many other ones, like ranging from, Shakespeare to Seamus Heaney translating Philoctetes to, like just all over the map. And so I kind of gathered this big archive of texts that were published in those couple of months afterwards and tried to look at what they were doing or saying kind of as a group. And I don't know if I don't use Williams like structure of feeling in the chapter, but I think for a lot of folks, that was where I was sitting a little bit. I use Williams throughout the book, and certainly like an inspiration to this project. But anyway, so this poem, this chapter writes about all these poems and tries to sketch the ways that, people were maybe using poetry to give particular voice to concerns about this sort of hypertrophic nationalism and this particularly this Islamophobic sentiments that were so prominent in the culture at that moment.
I mean, do you want to draw on a couple of examples, obviously, because there's three poems in particular?
Yes. One poem that probably everyone remembers, Amiri Baraka's Somebody Blew Up America, which he wrote right after the attacks, and it sort of blasted through the media, largely because it was accused of anti-Semitism, which is a thread in his work. So I read about that a little bit, but I try to contextualize Baraka in this larger spread, which includes, I write about a poem by Lorna de Cervantes called, which she originally titled Palestine. It's since been republished under a separate title. And then also this poem by a fairly obscure poet named Sam Hamad, who, his poem after the funeral of Assam Hamadi he read it on NPR about a month after September 11th, but this was a poem that he'd published in the 70s with a small press in Wisconsin. So it was this weird kind of collection, but all of these three poems, I argue, in this larger network of poems kind of make claims for sort of representation, particularly of the experience of like being a person of color. And they all speak specifically about, the experiences of Muslims after September 11th. But instead of like going really deep on my readings of the poems, what I really tried to do is show the ways that they were probably kind of, in this moment in conversation with other texts. So just to give an example without talking much about the poems, Lorna de Cervantes is a pretty well-known poet, like definitely a sort of in the world of poetry, right? She published this poem on about.com. This is not a place where most scholars or most poetry scene participants go for poems, I think it's fair to say. I was interested in the way that, like, how did that show up on about.com, and how did Hamad's poem being read by him on NPR, again, a place we don't necessarily go for poetry, if we're in the world of sort of literature and literary arts, how did these sort of give voice beyond those universes? And that's what, those three poems are sort of at least where they sit in that larger space.
I don't draw too much of a distinction between that analysis and then the second example, the second case study. But I suppose there we're talking, I mean, it's interesting to use the term structure of feeling, but, you know, we're talking about a set that maybe are, you know, imputed to this particular historical moment. Whereas the second chapter has got a much more kind of practical focus, because there's effectively, I guess, a kind of community organization that has, you know, kind of funding attached to it, has a project, and is dealing with, you know, a kind of set of obviously emotional and affective, but also really practical concerns. So I guess the moment here is kind of the story of the Big Read and the Jackson Services Fair.
Yeah. So I think... Yeah, and I actually think it's fair to draw a pretty big distinction. I mean, one of the things I realized in the September 11th chapter was the first part of the book I wrote. I realized, and I write this in a little bit about this in the book, like kind of trying to make that process visible a little bit. But I said, you know, this is just, I'm still too much in the space of me reading texts and trying to interpret their cultural meanings, you know? And so I wanted to kind of go out and like encounter some people reading, people who weren't really a lot like me. So it is, I think they're substantially different, although I try to argue that these are different ways of studying and thinking about how people use books to make political change. And that, so yeah, I think they're different but related. So I got some grant funding and I went, I used the Big Read, which is a National Endowment for the Arts funded kind of one book, one community reading program, which I think are, I don't know, are they common in the UK as well?
Not in the same exact way, but yeah, there's a kind of set of sort of community literature projects. Yeah, but not as kind of as national as the NEA programs.
Yeah, I think they become increasingly common. And I mean, I think, you know, there's a part of me as an academic that sort of wants to, you know, default to this snobbiness about it. But I also think they're like, they're really cool and interesting. In the book, I have some critiques of how the NEA and how the Big Read talk about reading, and particularly the way that they use the word community to elide a lot of differences. But anyway, I
mean, this with things like the BBC were exactly those notes of caution that you draw about who the NEA thinks a public is play out really kind of, in very similar ways, actually.
Yeah. And so I used them as a way to sort of identify groups. So this was in 2009. We're at that moment of the, you know, the sort of the Great Recession is sort of not yet named the Great Recession, but seems to be moving in that direction. So I went to these two communities that were reading John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, as these one book, one community reads, and tried to figure out what was going on. So I write about Jackson, which is a pretty small town in Michigan, about an hour and a half west of Detroit. And then I also write in that chapter about Knoxville, Tennessee. They were both reading the book. Different things were happening in both places, but in the chapter I use examples from both. So the Jackson Services Fair was the kickoff event for this one month, one book, one month thing. And it was just, I wanted to write about it in detail, and because it was such a, it's so not what most people think about when they think about books. This event, so it's in a high school gym. You know, there's people playing the Dust Bowl Ballads by Woody Guthrie. There's some people like dressed up a little bit in sort of 1930s style. The library is there with this giant like soup pot cooking over an open fire fit, like made out of soup cans. So like collecting food for people who are in need. So there's this like literary art culture thing happening, but then mixed into it are all of these kind of like social safety net organizations. So ranging from, I was going to pull up my list here, but I think I can do it from memory a little bit, but like ranging from groups that could help you get advice about how to avoid foreclosure to Big Brothers, Big Sisters, to groups that do kind of like, you know, small short-term loans to help people cover bills or whatever. So I thought this was a really fascinating intersection between literature, right? The reading of this like classic, you know, dead white guy novel, with a bunch of people being in this space where, yeah, they're talking about books, but they're also talking about how to get their immediate needs met. So that's, you know, that the chapter tells the story of kind of a bunch of the interactions that sort of kind of link off of that moment, or the idea that, and this is where the kind of the Habermasian thinking comes in, that there are networks that are created out of spaces like that.
And those networks give rise to kind of claims about, I guess, practical material redistribution, actually, you know, really things that I guess are quite contested in American politics at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think some of the, when the book was going through the review process, some of the reviewers were critical of the idea that there was, you know, actual, like that this claim about redistribution was legitimate. And I think a big part of what I'm trying to do in this chapter is adjust the scale. Like, redistribution matters for a person who's hungry when they get a free lunch. That's redistribution. And I'm sorry, you know, that's the scale we have in the US right now, but that's a meaningful scale. So there's very practical ways, right? People came and got food and took food with them. There was free transit to come to the fair. The library was a big part of the organization, but so were some community organizers who had pretty radical commitments. So I think there was a lot of really good thinking about the intersection between the text and the needs of the community. But just to give you an example of like how that, so there's like that very practical material redistribution in that moment. An example of kind of the way that's right. So subsequently, one of the people who helped to organize the fair is a minister. She gives two sermons over the course of the month, sort of talking about the grapes of wrath. The church hosts a book group discussion where sort of older folks and younger folks in the congregation are talking. The sermon links specific layoffs. And again, this is Michigan. So we're talking about, you know, the kind of collapse of the auto industry in these towns, sort of where she enumerates and, you know, this is that moment of, you know, representation of saying like, you know, 100 people in our community lost their jobs when this air filter plant closed. So she talks about it in the sermon. One of the congregants is one of the organizers of the service fair. Another one of the congregants is a woman who takes photos. So she takes photos of these women who've used these small community grants, makes them public. They're displayed in the library with texts sort of talking about these women's experience in the community and their experiences living in and moving through poverty. Well, those photos get picked up by their House of Representatives rep, who takes them to Washington, D.C. with the community action agency head to make the case for more federal funding for community. So, you know what I mean? I can go on and on, but there's ways that these experiences sort of ramify through time and space and continue to build up more and more claims for redistribution and other things.
I'm just, you sort of made me think actually of, although these practices are, you know, very kind of material and very political, you sort of shift focus again actually in the third chapter. And one of the things that fascinated me was the kind of reflexive moment in the third chapter, both, you know, the September 11th and the big read examples, I guess, would be quite standard academic territory to look at, you know, a kind of a moment within cultural history and then, you know, a set of practices responding to a particular financial emergency through reading and through a text. But in the third chapter, you sort of turn the lens back on the institution that is, you know, mediating the production of this kind of knowledge, asking questions about how the campus can actually be involved in these or in the need and the demand for a response to our current political moment. And I suppose you sort of set up an opposition between, on the one hand, a set of practices that you've tried to kind of encourage, perhaps through your teaching and your responses to individuals of text, and then the way that, you know, the kind of the American system is doing things through service learning. And I think it's really kind of fascinating to hear the story of text as tactics turn back inward to the institution that usually would be kind of almost absent, or, you know, kind of a ghost at the table in a lot of the research that went into chapters 1 and 2.
Yeah. And I mean, I think initially in my conception of the book, it was not, I wasn't going to talk about, you know, higher ed at all. Like, I'm interested in these sort of non-professional cultural workers, right? And as soon as we come onto campus, it's like, well, we're back in this space. But, you know, I care so much about teaching and I love doing it. And I did want to write about it. But I do want to give a shout out to, like, especially the folks in Jackson and Knoxville who, you know, they sort of shaped the way that I build this assignment. So, yeah, I mean, I don't want to be too pessimistic about the current political and cultural environment. But I think it's really common, I think, in my classes, and I'm sure in many people's classes, that when we read stuff, we, you know, there's just this weight that we're all carrying around, right? Like, my students are worried that, you know, their families are going to get deported, or that they're going to get deported by ICE agents. Like, it's tough to come to class and do good work when you're like that, when you're in that place. And so part of what I'm hoping that this assignment does is give students a way to identify agency. Again, even if it's sort of small agency, an agency to sort of do things. So in that chapter, I write about a literature class I teach called Working Class Literature. And two projects in particular from that class where students, the assignment, basically the final project, asked them to make our work public somehow. In that chapter, I guess I could tell you a million different stories, but there's the ones in the book are in great detail, but I'll mention a couple of things that students do and try to link that back to this idea of, like, not being totally pessimistic. Students often take this reading that we do in class. You know, we read, we interpret, we do the things probably, you know, most literature classes will do. And then students think, okay, like, how do I get this out there? So for their final project, some students have organized film screenings where they screen some of the films from our class and then talk with others about them, about sort of how class and you know, nation shape these characters' lives. One student did a beautiful thing where they created a like a display table for their community, like their county library, that sort of focalized working class literature, which I think most libraries, that's not like front and center of their mission. Another student did a like a zine where she sort of illustrated and then distributed these small quotes and pieces from some of the readings and from some other readings that she's done. So, you know, these are not seen as, like, traditionally, you know, final paper kind of projects. But I argue in the chapter that students did a ton of really important work to choose the texts, right? To interpret them, to think about the modes of distribution that would bring people into contact with these ideas and with these texts that, you know, they otherwise would likely never find. So I think there's a space there that where students seeing their own agency and their own ability to create something in conversation with the stuff that we're reading, and not just to create it in conversation with me or in conversation with a class, but in conversation with sort of a wider set of publics. I think that's a space where we can really identify, like, some hope and some agency and say, like, yeah, the reading change, however small, you know, in this context, largely focusing on kind of recognition and representation in other spheres. There's a second part to your question about service learning, but I wanted to pause and say, like, does that make sense, kind of?
Well, I'm just thinking, actually, that is quite an optimistic note. And obviously the kind of discussion of service learning is, you know, a kind of critical engagement of where institutions are not doing these things. And I wonder, actually, if we might kind of keep the spirit of optimism and think in terms of the kind of major theoretical end of the book, because obviously Habermasian approaches to, you know, communicative theory, but also to the political, have that same kind of moment of optimism within them. You know, they critique the kind of systems that we have. You know, they're kind of cautious about the possibility for social transformation, for things like recognition. But also there is that kind of moment of optimism. So I think maybe we might go from the kind of set of practices that, yeah, your students were engaged with in terms of making texts and making their work public to consider where kind of Habermas fits in. And maybe actually, I mean, it's obvious to me why his work was important, but yeah, maybe why his work was so important to the text, to the book.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's funny, like the optimism thing is part of it. Right. And I make a sort of, in the last chapter of the book, I make an argument, a reading of Habermas, right, that sort of situates him in the sort of foundational moments of critical theory. I'm not the only person to make that case, but I think it is a case that probably still needs to be made, because I think a lot of folks are fairly dismissive of Habermas, having, you know, mostly read, you know, the work of his that's most cited is the public sphere, the early public sphere stuff, which that's his dissertation. And, you know, if all great thinkers were known only by the work in their dissertation, well, I don't know that there'd be so many great thinkers. he is, his subsequent work has the idea of sort of communication, sort of outside of the idea that maybe if people communicate outside of trying to convince each other of things or try to sell each other things, that coordination and social change can happen. And, you know, again, that does put him at odds with, I think, some of the pessimism that is, you know, that runs through the Frankfurt School subsequent to, you know, in that first generation, I guess. So yeah, I use Habermas as a way to sort of talk through these networks and these sort of spaces that are created. I think I'll just make two quick points about where he's really useful. One is that I think his notion of kind of the communicative life world, so like the negotiation of language that happens. So I gave that sort of long strand of interactions that come out of the Grapes of Wrath in Jackson. That's a series of like a network of negotiations around language and around what to do and how to coordinate around language. And I think Habermas's theory really does a beautiful job of helping us see theoretically what that means and how that works. But also I think where, and this is why I think he's probably somewhat reviled, at least in my discipline, is because he also ties that to sort of, you know, the legal and, you know, he calls it juridical spheres, right? Where I think if you want to make change today in the world that we live in, you know, to channel Marx a little bit, in the world that we've inherited and the conditions we've inherited, it has to involve pushing towards those spheres, right? That's not sexy. It's not the sort of anarchist sublime, like revolutionary fantasy, but I think it's quite real. Anyway, so what Habermas does is he gives us a way to sort of ground the way those small exchanges, so a student's display in a public library, might change a conversation, might have a few more people using the word working class, instead of, you know, calling people poor, might focus people's thinking on work to some degree and how work plays into these things. But to say, yeah, that these like small interactions are part of larger networks, and part of what we might want to do if we believe in change and want to work for change is to try to identify those networks and how they're built. so I think that's, it's hard to talk about Habermas without going on and on, because as you know, his work is, massive. But that's kind of how I grab him. And I know that there's a couple of, just a footnote for folks listening, I know that there's a couple of new books that are soon to come out that do try to bring Habermas into conversations, particularly around literature and politics more. Jeff Bosher, I think, is writing one that's going to come out with Bloomsbury. So there is some, you know, more folks that are thinking about Habermas in these terms too, which I think is really exciting.
The sort of usually these podcasts is to kind of say, oh, you know, so what's your next project? Will there be a book? That kind of thing. But I guess one of the things I took away from this book, both actually, you know, in your kind of use of the optimism in Habermas and, you know, that kind of hope that we might change discourses and descriptions in American political life, and the case study examples that you analyze, I guess that kind of makes me wonder, is another book, you know, kind of appropriate, I guess, you know, would kind of community organization and, you know, the kind of the role of the teacher be really where you'd focus your efforts, or have you got, you know, a kind of close reading of poetry coming up?
Right. yeah, you're kind of looking into my soul here, but yeah, I think that's a question that I felt really strongly as I completed this project, and I write about it a little bit in the last chapter. But just this feeling of like, well, I'm glad I wrote this down, but I'm not sure that you know, it is important, I think, to have people sort of writing and thinking about it. But yeah, probably that there's more to do out there in the world. I do have a sort of a visionary a vision of what a next project might be, but it would probably not be an academic book. I'd really like to maybe do something more in depth where I work with readers and really talk to folks like some of the people I write in greater detail about their relationship to reading and their personal histories of reading. To sort of try to, you know, I don't know, track out through the particular experiences, particularly of like, you know, working class people, or again, folks who are sort of not part of the traditional conversation around books. I'd like to track out more of how people interact with texts. But in the meantime, yes, a lot of what I've been doing is trying to collaborate with folks in my college, with folks in other kind of public organizations around trying to think about how we help folks read to make change, and how we take the reading that many, many people already do and help them kind of plug it into the work of making a more just world that they value, and that I and those organizations value too.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I was talking to Nicholas Hengen Fox about reading as collective action, texts as tactics. Thank you.